Blessed is the power that did not get blown out in the windstorm. Blessed are the functioning microphones. Blessed is the heat. Blessed are the working kitchens in which our coffee and lunch will be prepared. Blessed are the washrooms. And blessed are all of you who came here today to engage in blessing, the practice of sharing what is good. I invite Mary Bercher to come kindle the flame of our faith. Blessed be. If there are any young people out in the seats, I invite you to come forward now for the kids' message. If you're new, you can bring your grown-up with you. It was candy sorting time on Halloween night. Max and his two sisters, one older, one younger, had each gone trick-or-treating with different groups of friends, and now they were back home counting and sorting their loot on the living room rug. Three separate piles. Max's little sister's pile, Max's older sister's pile. Max had had a good night. He was pleased to count 32 pieces of candy in his pile. But when he looked at his older sister's pile, he saw that she had way more than he did. She must have had 50 or even 60 pieces. All of a sudden, his 32 felt like not enough. Oh, he was so jealous. He asked her if he could have some, but she refused. "No way," she said. "I earned this." Then Max turned to check out what his little three-year-old sister had collected. She had gone trick-or-treating with their mom, but only made it halfway down the block before she decided her costume was too scratchy and she wanted to go home. Her pile had only 5 pieces of candy. When Max thought about how he would feel if he had only 5 pieces of candy, his pile of 32 suddenly felt huge. In a burst of generosity, he reached into his pile, grabbed a handful of his candy, and gave it to his little sister. Her big, surprised eyes and wide grin made him feel all warm and happy inside. She ran to their mom, chanting, "Max shared his candy! Max shared his candy!" As Max grew older, he remembered that night. He realized that whether it's about candy or toys or money, he will always have more than some people and less than other people. Personally, he felt better when he shared what he had with those who had less. When he started to earn money, Max began a new practice of setting aside a part of whatever he earned in a giveaway jar. For every $5 he earned, he would put 50 cents into his giveaway jar. Then he used that money to give to things like the Terry Fox Run at school or the Guide Dogs program that his church was sponsoring. When his little sister got older, inspired by Max, she started her own giveaway jar. Their older sister thought they were both nuts. So I wonder, have any of you ever done anything like that? Have you ever given money away to a good cause or shared something that you had with something with someone else? Matea?
I don't want to say it.
You. Okay.
Jackson?
I shared money with the food bank.
Oh, with a food bank. Awesome.
And I keep like a giveaway kind of pile, which is like the exact same thing as in the story.
Funny that.
Yeah.
Anyone else? Yeah, Jenny.
I raise money for the Rays of Sunshine Foundation.
And what's Rays of Sunshine for?
It kind of grants wishes for kids with serious illnesses.
Oh, cool. Thanks. Yeah, Kiana.
When I was at downtown, I saw
a homeless person having his hat out, and with my money full of purse, I grabbed the ham bunch and put in his hat.
Oh, that's so nice. Thanks, Kiana. Thank you. Generosity. I'm inspired by your generosity. Thank you for sharing, and thank you for listening. You can stand as... Oh, Natty had one thing to say. Hold on. Natty?
I shared food with a lady who got run over.
Oh.
She was walking on the road. She didn't get run over. She was walking on the road.
You shared food with a lady who was walking on the road. That's nice, too. Okay, now we can stand and go to your classes, walk, and the grown-ups will stand, form the arches, and sing you on your way. We will begin today's meditation with a piece from our Soul Matters program. It is written by John O'Donohue and is entitled, A Blessing for One Who is Exhausted. If you feel comfortable doing so, you may want to listen with your eyes closed. Breathe in, breathe out. When the rhythm of the heart becomes hectic, time takes on the strain until it breaks. Then all the unattended stress falls in on the mind like an endless, increasing weight. The light in the mind becomes dim. Things you could take in stride before now become laborsome events of will. Weariness invades your spirit. Gravity begins falling inside you, dragging down every bone. The tide you never valued has gone out, and you are marooned on unsure ground. Something within you has closed down, and you cannot push yourself back to life. You have been forced to enter empty time. The desire that drove you has relinquished. There is nothing else to do now but rest and patiently learn to receive the self you have forsaken for the race of days. At first your thinking will darken and sadness take over like listless weather. The flow of unwept tears will frighten you. You have traveled too fast over false ground. Now your soul has come to take you back. Take refuge in your senses. Open up to all the small miracles you rushed through. Become inclined to watch the way of rain when it falls slow and free. Imitate the habit of twilight, taking time to open the well of color that fostered the brightness of day. Draw alongside the silence of stone until its calmness can claim you. Be excessively gentle with yourself. Stay clear of those vexed in spirit. Learn to linger around someone of ease who feels they have all the time in the world. Gradually, you will return to yourself, having learned a new respect for your heart and the joy that dwells far within slow time. Breathe in, breathe out. Let us remain seated as we continue our meditation by singing together hymn number 86. 86. Blessed be.
For approximately 2 weeks, I have been dealing with a very sore right knee. I've had problems with this knee for several years, and while I was doing some mild muscle strengthening exercises under supervision, my knee cracked, snapped, and popped, and I almost fell to the ground. I was not expecting this. I was doing so well. I thought I was being proactive and following a good plan. Then life threw me a curve. I've had this time to mull over this unfortunate turn of events, mumbling, "Why me? Why now? I may be a likely candidate for surgery, but now isn't a good time. It doesn't fit in with my schedule. Besides, we all know that I would have a lengthy wait, even if I was put on a list tomorrow. Yay for John. So right now, I don't feel particularly blessed. I can tell I'm falling into a bit of a woe-is-me pattern. My husband and I have plans to take a holiday in 6 weeks, and I'm wondering how this is going to work. Right now, it's all about me. And then I read Reverend Mellor's outline in the October newsletter, which states, and she mentioned it this morning too, all of us have more than some and less than others. Someone always has it worse, and someone always has it better. I really had to keep reading that statement over and over, as I knew in my heart this to be true, but I needed to acknowledge this in my head as well. And on further contemplation, I am grateful and, yes, very blessed with so many aspects of my life. My family and friends who love and support me, a roof over my head to shelter me from the cold and the rain, enough food to eat, and so many other examples of good fortune. One only has to see the devastating pictures coming out of Haiti after the ravages of Hurricane Matthew, or the daily ongoing human suffering in Aleppo. At times like this, I feel our world, which has become overheated, overcrowded, overwhelmed, and whose kindness and generosity has been mistreated, its resources plundered, fouled, and depleted. No wonder I feel that it is all too much. Now, I'm aware that I'm spending way too much time focusing on what is broken rather than what is good. This month of blessing and thanksgiving has allowed me the opportunity to really examine what is working in my life. This church community is definitely one of those. Here I have found a place of comfort, care, and consideration of what matters most. The amazing people of this congregation who give so tirelessly and unselfishly of their time and energy have created a place of warmth and friendship, love and acceptance, values worth upholding and cherishing. This is our shelter from the storm in a chaotic world, and I am infinitely blessed to be a part of it.
You're at a social gathering, a dinner party, a kid's soccer game, church coffee hour, and someone mentions money. Worse than that, the talk turns to income, how much people earn. Can you feel the knots forming in our collective stomachs? Maybe some of you come from families or subcultures that are perfectly comfortable talking about money. But many among us were raised to think that talking about money is impolite at best. Some among us find it downright offensive. It's kind of like our culture's relationship with sex. On the one hand, it's all over the media. Images and talk of sex and money are everywhere. On the other hand, our relationships with these topics are so messed up and shame-laden and wrapped up in taboo that addressing either topic directly in conversation is liable to stir up discomfort, often verging on low-level communal panic. But we Unitarian Universalists are countercultural. We don't shy away from the hard stuff. We push through denial and ignorance and look with honest clarity at what is really there. It's what we teach our kids in our sexuality education programs, for it lays the foundation for healthy relationships with self and others. Open and honest conversation about both facts and emotions. In so doing, we demystify sex. We take away the shame and taboo and see it for what it is, not such a big deal, just a part of life. So let's try that with money. Let's talk about it. Why does the topic of money feel so loaded? What emotions does it stir up? There's an incident I remember from my early 20s that I go back to again and again. Two high school friends of mine who had ended up going to the same university were complaining to me about each other. We will call the friends Jessica and Rachel. This happened in two separate one-on-one conversations. In the first conversation, Jessica told me, "I'm so annoyed with Rachel. Whenever we hang out, she's always so cheap. She never wants to go out to eat. She says it's too expensive. She's such a hypocrite. She says she can't afford eating out, but then she pays those crazy expensive membership dues to belong to her sorority." Later, in a different conversation with Rachel, Rachel made a very similar complaint about Jessica. Jessica says she didn't want to join the sorority this year because she can't afford the dues. But that's so not true. She just bought a brand new stereo system. Can you believe that? I remember puzzling over the set of conversations later. On one level, each one was accusing the other of the same thing, being too cheap, claiming something was too expensive and that they couldn't afford it when in fact they did have some available funds. But really, they were judging each other for their particular spending choices. Each had a different set of values and spent their money accordingly. Rachel valued belonging to a sorority over eating out. Jessica valued eating out and having a new stereo over belonging to a sorority. One was no more cheap or wasteful than the other. They just had different priorities. The incident taught me a couple of things. First of all, it underscored for me that how we choose to spend our money is an indicator of what we value. Secondly, it highlighted that one of the reasons we can feel uncomfortable about money is that so many people are quick to judge how any of us spends our money. If we spend too little, we are called cheap. If we spend too much, we are called wasteful. Anyone with slightly different spending priorities might feel moved to judge another's choices. In extreme cases, these judgments can take the form of moral condemnation. Maybe this has happened to you. Have you ever felt that your spending choices were being judged by someone? So many possible judgments. It can make a person want to keep one's spending choices private. It can make a person want to avoid talking about money at all. There are a bunch of other icky feelings that can be stirred up when we talk about money. As Susan mentioned, and as the kids' message highlighted, most of us have more than some and less than others. This fact can be liberating. It can also be upsetting. When we look at people who have more than we do, we might fall prey to feelings of envy or resentment. I wish I could afford what they have. Why should they be so lucky? Sometimes those feelings can slip into shame or embarrassment. Advertising relies on this shame. It tries to make us feel like whatever we have isn't good enough. whether it's clothes, electronics, vacations. Go ahead, the ads whisper. Max out your credit card to get something better. Embarrassment, envy, resentment. There are even more negative emotions waiting to trap us on the flip side of this dynamic. When we look at people who have less than we do, we can fall prey to feelings of guilt. I have a friend who says he feels this way when he walks past homeless people downtown, especially if he's just gone out to dinner or purchased something non-essential. He says he also feels this way when he's in conversation with anyone who is living on less than what he does. He says he feels a sense of embarrassment that makes him want to downplay what he has. It's weird that we can feel both embarrassment about having more than others, as well as embarrassment about having less than others. Another weird facet about our culture's relationship with money is that we can feel anxious about money almost regardless of how much we actually have. Maybe millionaires don't feel anxious about money, but what I've noticed is that if I think of the people I know who have said that they're anxious about finances, those people cover a wide range of the financial spectrum. You don't have to be destitute to be anxious about money. I myself have been known to be anxious about money. Perhaps you recall my sermon from a couple years ago called Confessions of a Penny Pincher. I mentioned that I do things like stand in the grocery aisle with my cell phone calculator trying to figure out whether the regularly priced economy size really does offer the better price per milliliter than the on-sale regular size. Also, though I have tempered it now with a desire to live more simply, I am still enticed by offers of free stuff. Hence the title of this homily, Hoarding Hotel Hand Cream. It started when I was in grad school. Whenever I attended professional conferences, I would collect those little bottles of shampoo, conditioner, and hand cream offered for free in hotel rooms. I didn't just take home the bottles at the end of my five-day stay, and I don't know if I've confessed this before. I don't think I have. I would put the bottles from day one into my luggage so that new bottles would appear when they restocked on day two, and then I'd put those in my luggage, and so on. Jan says I'm not alone. Why did I do this? Sure, I would make use of some of them later when I traveled to visit friends and family, and I made them available to guests who visited me. But truth be told, I didn't really use as much as I collected. At one point, I purged my supply and my conscience by giving them away to a homeless shelter. But then I heard that the shelter had enough, and I started, not because of me, and I started to worry about the waste, right, of all those little plastic bottles going into landfills. So now at least when I go to a hotel, I no longer stash each day's supply in my luggage. I make do with the one set. But the impulse to hoard is still there. Why? What is that about? I think it's fear, a generalized fear of not having enough. Not hand cream per se, but stuff in general. My anxiety makes me want to do this instead of this. I don't think I'm alone. Like I've said, I've noticed that a lot of people all over the financial spectrum feel anxious about money. So, talking about money can raise feelings of anxiety, fear, guilt, shame, envy, resentment, judgment, and fear of judgment. No wonder we don't like talking about money. The more I thought of this, the more I felt sort of sorry for money. I mean, money is just money, but it gets such a bad rap. It's like the poor, maligned egg. I don't know if they had this ad up in Canada. Years ago in the States, we went through a period where the health experts were down on eggs. Eggs are bad for you, they warned. Avoid eating eggs. Too much cholesterol. And then, when the health experts revised their opinions and moved on to new theories about which foods were dangerous, the egg people put out these ads with an image of an egg behind bars being let out of jail. The prison door is open. The egg is liberated. I love eggs, so I cheered along, "Yes, free the egg!" I feel kind of like that about money. I wonder if we might free money from its prison of a bad reputation. After all, money is not bad in and of itself. In fact, money can be used for good. Susan and Max in the kids' message have both given us a good place to start. Here's what I do. When I feel that stomach-clenching, hoarding hotel hand cream kind of anxiety starting to build, I try to shift my thinking. When I take the time to stop and notice what is good in my life, noticing even the little things I appreciate, a warm mug of coffee, a good novel to read, a moving piece of music. Feelings of envy, guilt, and anxiety soften and fade. I start to feel little glimmers of gratitude. All yesterday, for example, as the rain fell and the winds blew, I was feeling so thankful to have a home, an indoor space to keep me warm, safe, and dry. When I sit in that feeling of gratitude, like Max with his pile of candy, I feel more open to this month's practice, sharing what is good. And like Max with his candy, sharing what is good makes me feel even better. I have a trick I use that makes this even easier for me in view of my anxiety-prone tendencies and controlling nature. The best financial advice I ever got was from an advisor in grad school who told a class of us, whatever income you earn, before you spend any of it, set aside 10% for savings, 10% for giving away, and then live on the remaining 80%. It was so useful to get this advice early. When I was still living on stipends, loans, and part-time minimum wage jobs, I essentially pretended that I only had 80% of what I actually had and adjusted my living accordingly. Then when a charity asked for donations, I had this whole little pot of money at the ready. It cut down on my anxiety about giving because it was already in my budget, and it felt so good to be able to give something even when I wasn't making all that much to begin with. I'll admit that as I aged, I slipped a bit. I've not been as consistent about the 10% savings part. And when we do our tithing calculation, we do it based on take-home pay, not gross income. Still, it's enough that it feels good. Shauna and I do what some called a Unitarian Universalist tithe. Traditional Christians, you may have heard, give 10% of their earnings to their churches. But like other Unitarian Universalists, we want to support other causes as well. So we give 5% to the congregation we serve and 5% to all our other favorite values-based organizations. I've heard of religious organizations that charge membership fees. You can get a reduced fee, but you have to apply for it. I like that our congregations let each person choose what level of giving feels good to them. And I like that the practice of tithing, if you choose to do tithing, is done in percentage instead of flat amounts. It feels more equitable, more appreciative of the gifts of people from the whole range of economic means. I like that in a system of tithing, when I was a student making not so much money, I felt like my 5% contribution was valued just as highly as the 5% of the members who were making more. I felt good about what I was able to give. Unitarian Universalist theologian Reverend Rebecca Parker writes about tithing in her book called Blessing the World, What Can Save Us Now? The book looks at all the hard stuff that is happening in our world today and offers insight into how we as Unitarian Universalists can work toward healing and wholeness. Most of what she says is deep, far-ranging, big-picture analysis, but there's one chapter that lifts up two personal spiritual practices: observing a Sabbath day of rest and tithing, giving away 10% of one's income. She writes, quote, "One reason tithing is important is that causes we believe in will flourish if we share more of our resources. If we want our values to shape society, we need to generously fund organizations that support them. But," she says, "there is a deeper, more fundamental spiritual reason to tithe." She quotes a Unitarian Universalist congregant who said, quote, "I tithe because to tithe is to tell the truth about who I am. If I did not tithe, it would say that I was a person who had nothing to give, a person who had received nothing from life, a person who did not matter to the larger society, or whose life's meaning was in providing for his own needs alone. But in fact," he says, who I am is the opposite of all these things. I am a person who has something to give. I am a person who has received abundantly from life. I am a person whose presence matters in this world. And I am a person whose life has meaning because I am connected to and care about many things larger than myself. If I did not tithe, I would lose track of these truths about who I am." End quote. I like that thought that giving is an expression of our interdependence. Like we often say in our offertory words, as Unitarian Universalists, we recognize that we are interconnected in this web of life, so we share what we have and give what we can. So let's help money out of its prison of a bad reputation. Money can be used for good. Giving can feel good, especially when we give to organizations that promote and act upon the values we believe in, like our UU congregations. At the family and fellowship luncheon today after the service, the ABC annual budget campaign team will tell us the details we need to know about the 2017 budget. They'll tell us that we need about $21,000 more than we pledged last year to keep things at status quo. They will note that we would need an additional $11,500 beyond that to get our staff up to living wage and fair compensation standards. And they'll give us a bunch of other useful numbers. That will help us figure out the amounts we wish to give. In the meantime, I invite us to think about the reasons we might want to give. What do we do here that you feel good about supporting? What good have you found here that you might wish to sustain so that others can share it too? Maybe you like belonging to a religion that has no creed but instead encourages each person to find their own spiritual path. Maybe our seven principles, our core values, have become touchstones for you. You feel good about being a part of a religion that holds at its center an affirmation of the inherent worth and dignity of every person, and respect for the interdependent web of life of which we are all a part. Maybe the good you found here is more concrete. You appreciate how the music nourishes your spirit, or you appreciate being a part of a network of people who care for one another in times of joy and times of loss. Or maybe you appreciate how the Social Responsibility Coalition does the organizing work that enables us to combine our efforts to care for the larger world. Maybe there's someone that you are glad that you met through this congregation. When I was thinking about the blessings of this community, one specific image came to mind: our daughter, Athena, knitting with church member Catherine Moss. At the church auction a year and a half ago, Athena got the lessons Catherine offered on how to knit socks. Catherine generously met with Athena for more times than the lessons probably included, and over time, they got to know each other and chatted about other things. This was last fall during the election season, and I remember how delighted Athena was to have someone else to talk to about her passion for politics. I remember how grateful I felt that such a thing could happen. Here was an adult, a lovely person with sound values and a compassionate heart, unrelated to my kid, taking a genuine interest in getting to know her as a person. This is the gift of intergenerational community. Extra grown-ups to love and support all of our children as they learn and grow. And of course, even the kids who don't happen to bid on knitting lessons can get this kind of support and connection through our phenomenal spiritual exploration and learning program for children and youth. I am so excited about the innovative programming that Faye is offering through our new Outdoor Forest Guardians and Indoor Spirit Arts program. And I love that our congregations offer the unique gift of a multi-level sexuality education program that supports the whole person as they learn how to build healthy, respectful relationships with themselves, with others, and the larger human community. This year's grade 8 and 9 OWL program has something like 15 kids in it. The kids in all of our programs give me such hope. They are each figuring out how to use their own unique gifts and passions to make this world a better place. I feel really good about supporting that blessing. There's one more blessing I'd like to mention. I know most people think that the property part of a church budget is boring. They say people give to programs, not buildings. But I feel really good about sharing this beautiful place. I love how it serves as a spiritual retreat for so many of us. I think of the overworked and overwhelmed person who finds peace here as they pause, gaze across the valley, and take in the view. I think of the lonely person who finds a sense of connection during our communal meditation and singing held in the soothing place of this sanctuary. I think of the grieving person who finds comfort sitting on a bench under a tree by the memorial wall. I think of the children who find joy running up the forest path to the yurt or exploring the new nature playground. I feel good about sustaining the gift of this space for all who need it. I'll also note that as a person who likes good budgetary planning, I feel extra good about supporting the well-thought-out long-range maintenance plan our property people have created. So much better to pay less now for preventative measures than to pay more later because we've let something fall apart. I'll ask again, what have you found here that you consider to be a blessing? What good have you found that you would like others to be able to share? Our UU communities are like little dojos, little communal hubs where we come together to renew our spirits and practice being our best selves. You could say that our UU communities help us be a blessing in the world. Individually and together, we can be a blessing. We can share what is good. So may it be. Our closing beatitudes. Blessed are you who are willing to talk about money. Blessed are you who are still uncomfortable talking about money, but stayed with us anyway. Blessed are you who find ways to use money for good. Blessed are you who, in the face of having less than some and more than others, are able to appreciate what is good in your life and share what is good with others. for all the ways, great and small, in which each of you bless this world every day. I say thank you, blessed be, and amen.